You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, November 10th, 2015. My name is Michael Brooks. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Mike LaRussa. He's a Latin American security analyst, researcher, and podcaster. We're talking about his new piece in the Jacobin magazine, Giuliani in Rio, how Rudy Giuliani has built a consulting business exporting his zero-tolerance approach to crime across Latin America, from Mexico to Brazil to Trinidad and Tobago, with similar results to the ones he had in New York City. Not so great. We'll get into the details of that with Mike. Also, workers striking across the country for a living wage. We'll check in with them. Saudi Arabia executions reach a 20-year high, according to a new Amnesty International report. Benjamin Netanyahu and Barack Obama pretending to like each other in Washington, D.C., not convincing anybody. But does it really matter to the Palestinians? Not so much. They're not getting a state. The occupation's not ending. None of that's happening anytime soon. Donald Trump hosted Saturday Night Live. And savvy ratings grab by Saturday Night Live. The problem is people actually watched it and were reminded of just how boring that show can be. Wow. Unbelievable. Nothing really else to say about that. You can start taking me down. New Matt. New Doc. Wait, oh, worlds collided there for a second. I'm sorry about that. How are you guys doing? New Matt?
It's appropriately rainy for the second GOP debate in a row.
That's
today.
Right. That's right. Classic Kelly in a very grouchy mood, not responding to my greeting, salutation. That's okay.
I'm doing well, and I don't appreciate your aggression.
Okay. Can you take her mic down, please? Tonight the Republicans are debating. You're right, but it rained the last time the Republicans debated, and what I remember was I never read the Harry Potter books, but I did watch some of the movies, and I remember when I was in college. I forget what year in college I was, but the year that Obama won in 08, I got, and it was terrible. This woman, she was a great professor, but she made us have a night class on election night. So we're sitting in class listening. It's like, I don't want to talk about, it was an interesting class. It was like Japanese cinema or something, but it was like, are you kidding me? Like, I want to see who's winning the frigging election. And it wasn't, and I didn't have an iPhone or anything. Yeah, this is still 2008 where it wasn't as ubiquitous. So you actually had to like check a computer. And I remember we were walking out and it was clear, like there was no suspense. Like Obama was winning. And it was this really gray, overcast, foggy night in Maine. And I remember this kid I was walking out with, he's like, dude, it's like the Dementors are like leaving there, like getting dislodged and light is winning. And I was like, that was pretty funny. And then we continued the drug programs. Yes, what were you going to say, Kelly?
I was actually in Times Square because that's where my very close to where my grad school classes building was.
Right.
And people just went absolutely bananas in the streets.
Yeah,
were
it was
just
amazing.
Freaking out and so overjoyed. And I mean, some of them probably didn't even know what the reasoning was, but everyone just, you know, ran around. And then I went home to the Williamsburg area, and people there were even more. I mean, they thought like it was like the government had been overthrown.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. No, it was people were. It was also just like an energetic thing. And where were you, Matt? Were you off with your parents, like storing food in some bunker? Oh boy,
no,
what's happening?
I think I was actually in a night class myself. I remember being in a
what the hell?
It was like journalism.
What's the matter with
level.
These people having a night class on a light? And it's a journalism class. At least my class was like.
Yeah,
this has nothing to do with anything.
I think we watched it like in the class, though. I'm pretty sure.
All right. Well, good for you. All right, folks. We're going to be right back with Mike LaRusso. But first, I got to tell you about today's sponsor. And today's sponsor is Casper Mattress. It's obsessively engineered, American-made mattresses. Kelly and Matt are looking at me like they're satisfied Casper Mattress customers. Like I'm sure everybody is. Yep. And they're mattresses at a shockingly low price. And you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority and using code majority. It's as simple as that. Listen, you spend about a third of your life sleeping. If you're Kelly, that's like half of your life just sleeping. If you're Matt, he has some type of special bizarre sleep schedule where he does like a half hour every 3 hours. He read it in Marcus Aurelius and it's bizarre. But the point is no matter what kind of regimen you're on, you got to be doing it on a good mattress, okay? It's a third of your life. Casper brings together two comfy technologies for better nights and brighter days, latex foam and memory foam. I like that memory foam. So they've just got the right sink, just the right bounce, no matter how you sleep. And they've got a risk-free trial and return policy for a mattress. They'll deliver it straight to you. You can try it for 100 days. And if you're not happy, they'll pick it up. I mean, that's ridiculous. You can't get that for almost any other purchase I can imagine. And this is one of the biggest purchases you're ever going to make. At the store, maybe you'll get a minute to try a mattress and you look like a moron. You ever see people at stores hopping on mats? It's like, dude, you're not. Do it when you're a kid. And when you're a kid, keep your shoes on and grind it into the mattress and have fun. But besides that, if you're an adult, you look ridiculous. All right, with Casper, you'll actually get to sleep on it. Literally, it's $500 for a twin size mattress and $950 for a king size mattress. That's insane. Compare that to the industry average, and it's an outstanding price point. Absolutely, to get 50 towards any mattress purchase by going to majority.com/majority using code majority. Again, that's code majority. Casper.com/majority, code majority. There's a link to it on their website. It's another no-brainer. Brought to you by Casper Mattresses. We'll be right back with Mike LaRusso on the Majority Report.
Eternal fire, not in Babylon, you walk again, bruise. And you want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. I want them. Ooh, yeah. Pack up and go. Me, I beg you, move. Yeah. I beg you, pack up and go. Me said that movement alive. Marcus said fi organize and centralize. Rasta fi own banks and enterprise. So me nah stop chanting, my soul enter Zion. Princes of fire, Babylon me tell her your time just expire. What kind of wickedness me a transpire? And no gasoline and a tire. Eternal fire, nothing Babylon you want to get bruised. Me a want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. We are want them. Ooh, yeah. Ooh, yeah. I beg your papa one more. Me I tell you, ooh, yeah. Ooh, yeah. I tell your papa one more. Where them a go with a key and saltish? Better them give me a key and garlic. That's
fish right. Pass me a map and a compass on ya. Make me show them say salt fish no come from on ya. That fish they come a far way. They bring him all the way from Norway. Hey, I could the rest of them a try fi trick her. That kill me me national dish a eternal fire. And dirty Babylon you a go get bruised. Me a want them fire. I said you just can't win, you're going to lose. Johnny killer want them move, yeah. I beg you pack up and go. Me a tell you move, yeah. I beg you move, quick, pack up and go. Oh, tell me why. Every time I hear about Africa, I shackles and chains. Tell me why. You try to corrupt the liquor, Rastaman brain. And if you tell the youth them to Africa exists long before the middle passes. Me come to tell the ghetto youth them for white because Babylon a brainwash the masses a fire. The dirty Babylon you will go get bruised. We a want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. We a want them.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Mike La Russa. He is an independent journalist and Latin American security analyst. And his new piece in the Jacobin magazine, Giuliani in Rio, how Rudy Giuliani is crisscrossing the Americas, spreading the draconian policies he pioneered in New York City, came out just a couple of days ago. Mike, thanks so much for joining us on the Majority Report.
Thanks for having me on.
So I want to start by, I guess, in your piece, and I think it's worthwhile to sort of go back into the history a little bit, of getting back to the Giuliani era in New York City, because that sets the stage for understanding what he's doing in places like Brazil, places like Trinidad and Tobago, Mexico. Rudy Giuliani ran and was elected on a really racially charged platform when he ran against David Dinkins in, I believe it was 1993. And he pioneered not just broken windows, which people are still familiar with because Bratton is back under Bill de Blasio, but also a zero tolerance approach to policing in the city. And there was a number of brutality cases associated with Giuliani and really an aggressive attitude towards the victims in those cases. So bring us back to Rudy Giuliani's tenure in New York City. Explain to us what he pioneered and how he established this reputation, which has propelled a global security business.
Right. Well, so I think it's worthwhile to go back a little, maybe even a little further than, sure, than his mayoral term. He actually got his start as a federal prosecutor and really went hard after what he called crime, crack, and corruption. So that was sort of in the 1970s, sort of the beginning of the drug war. And then during the 80s, when it really ramped up under Reagan, that was sort of when he started building that reputation. And he kind of used that as a, you know, platform that he used during his mayoral campaign as well. And when he became mayor, like you said, he did bring in Bill Bratton. I think here it's maybe important to distinguish between broken windows, which was the policy that was developed by two criminologists that Bill Bratton eventually adopted, mm-hmm, and zero tolerance, which was sort of a later policy. Broken windows, the theory goes, if you deter people from doing minor crimes like graffiti, selling things on the street, driving taxi cabs without a license, those sorts of crimes, that will somehow deter more serious crimes like murder and bigger thefts. The evidence for that, I think, is not quite there. But what Giuliani did over the course of time, he actually ended up firing Bratton because crime rates went down in New York City, and the public seemed to attribute that to Bratton's policies, and Giuliani seemed a little bit jealous about that. So mm-hmm. He ended up forcing Bratton out, bring in a guy named Howard Safir, who is a former DEA agent. And under Safir, they really sort of developed this zero tolerance policy, which is sort of like broken windows on steroids. So the idea being that you can't allow any crimes whatsoever. And I think that that is the policy that Giuliani has continued to promote in Latin America.
And just to be specific, so people who are of a different generation, even frankly, because this is already several years ago. So, you know, I guess people like you and I are sort of even reading about it. But people remember in New York City, the squeegee men was the sort of prime example of this. And these guys would basically right. come out with a squeegee in the middle of traffic and offer to wipe off your windshield for a buck or two. And, you know, some people found it to be a little annoying. Some people appreciated it because you get your window cleaned for a buck or two. These guys were, I mean, they were treated with a sort of level of ferocity by the Giuliani police as if they were, you know, running up to people's windows coming out of Long Island or under the Holland Lincoln Tunnel and handing them a vial of crack. I mean, the level of aggressiveness towards crimes like that was stunning and really a reflection of this zero tolerance approach. It also was a major target used against the homeless population as well. And one of the ironies of it is that people would actually say about Giuliani, and some of it obviously was kind of an ethnic joke about his heritage for sure, which I guess is problematic. But there was a lot of comments about, you know, this mentality fits more in like Latin America or some type of, you know, Italian neo-fascist thing. That was the sort of joke about Giuliani. But that said, he did, as a result of this policy, move into Latin America with this business model and with the same approach to approaching crime. There's a lot to get into here in terms of the efficacy of it, in terms of how this relates to the conversations about gentrification, which will bring us back to New York. But first, I mean, why do you think Latin America versus, you know, why wasn't he collecting accounts in Asia or Europe? What was it that made the Latin American market so ripe for Giuliani?
Well, I think that's a tough question to answer, and I'm not sure that I know exactly why he was so active in Latin America, but I do know that this zero tolerance type policy actually tends to be quite popular, not just among elites in Latin American countries, but also oftentimes among sort of everyday citizens. Mm-hmm. It's currently the most violent region in the world. Recently, the UN said that it has surpassed Africa as having the most violent deaths of any region on Earth.
Right.
And for a long time, they've struggled with problems of organized crime and gangs and really lots of, you know, pretty terrible violence. And so I think that it's a simplistic sort of solution. You know, we're just going to come in and say, we're not going to tolerate any crimes. That's, you know, everything from low level extortion to high level murders. And I think that that appeals to a lot of people at sort of a gut level. You know, and again, I think we can talk more about whether the evidence is there for how effective it is, but I think that's part of the appeal.
Yeah, so that actually tracks with New York City, because there was the same coalition that backed Giuliani was certainly the economic elites of the city, and then absolutely, as you say, a lot of working class people who were just tired of not being able to go to an ATM without feeling like, you know, they had to look over their shoulder. It wasn't like the crime crisis in New York was a manufactured or made up thing. It was real. I mean, and the same in Latin America. But I also think, and something you touch on, so we'll get to specifically, let's go to Mexico. One of the first contracts that Giuliani and partners acquired when he left office was Carlos Slim, who's a Mexican billionaire, and a group of other elites brought him to Mexico City to implement these zero tolerance policies there. I want you to talk about, first of all, we'll get to whether or not these are successful, but also the fact that, as you say, that in the strategy that Giuliani outlined didn't mention poverty. It didn't mention unemployment. It had very brief and scattered mentions about human rights and really focused specifically on this zero tolerance approach, which, as you say, in New York City, is also the precursor to the levels of gentrification that New York has had. Because when you start expanding this crime set, like, we can all agree that, okay, if somebody's involved in violence, that's obviously a problem. But when you start saying, you know, if you're sitting on your stoop and having a beer, arresting and harassing that person is connected to a much larger picture about what you're trying to make a place to be racially and economically. So I'm curious, in the Mexico City example, you know, was there a sort of elite corollary to that with people like Carlos Slim of trying to fully make it over in the New York image, not just in terms of cutting crime, but also in terms of cleaning out socially undesirables, frankly?
Yeah, no, I think that was definitely a part of it. You know, Carlos Slim and that group of sort of people that reportedly funded Giuliani's report there, they specifically said that they wanted to clean up the city, which is a phrase that sort of comes up again and again when you're talking about these kind of policies. And that involved, you know, like you said, sort of targeting street vendors, people that were drunk in public, that sort of thing. And, you know, that can perhaps make it appear as though things are safer if you sort of sweep these people off the street and into jails. But then you have the question of how you're allocating your resources, right? I mean, a lot of these Latin American countries and cities like Mexico City, they don't have a whole lot of spare resources lying around. And so if you're using your police resources to target these sort of low-level criminals, you have to wonder if you're sort of letting the bigger fish get away. And I think that, you know, there's some evidence that that has happened. Recently, Mexico City has been experiencing some increases in crime, especially increases in indications that organized crime, which hadn't had a huge presence there previously, could be making sort of inroads into that city. So I think the long-term efficacy of these sorts of policies really, really comes into question, especially when you're talking about Mexico City.
Yeah, and in fact, we'll get back to that, because I want to go to that other question in terms of what levels of crime we're talking about, particularly when we're talking about Latin America. But before we do, let's just do a tour, basically. You touched on Mexico City. There's also contracts in Brazil and contracts in Trinidad and Tobago. Just run us through what were the actual results like of, and also who, in what context in these places. We already said in Mexico, Carlos Slim brought him in. In Trinidad, I think it was an insurance company that brought Giuliani in. And in Brazil, I think it was having to do with the Olympics. Take us on a tour through these contracts and just explain the results and the efficacy.
Yeah, so I mean, we talked a little bit about Mexico City, yeah. And shortly after Giuliani and his firm released their report with their recommendations for Mexico City, he did travel to Trinidad and Tobago. Mm-hmm. And while he was there, he gave a speech for at a law enforcement forum that was hosted by a major financial corporation there. But what ended up happening is the Trinidadian security ministry sort of looked into what the results of his program in Mexico City were, and they decided that that was not the way that they wanted to go. So they ended up contracting with a group of academic experts led by a guy named Stephen Mistrovsky, mm-hmm. Who's a really interesting character, and I got to speak with him for this piece. And basically, he said that Giuliani's advice tends to boil down to do what we did in New York, which is, you know, the broken windows, zero tolerance sort of policies that we talked about. And Professor Mistrovsky was skeptical about their efficacy. He recommended that the Trinidadian police focus less on targeting small-time crime and that sort of thing, and focus on some of the basics of policing. So, for example, he told me that when he went there, sometimes there's a procedure called a roll call, where the officers show up and they get their assignments for the day from their superiors, and that wasn't happening when he got there. Mm-hmm. So you sort of had these police officers kind of going out, maybe showing up for work, maybe not. If they were showing up, there wasn't really a whole lot of accountability for what they were doing. There weren't standardized ways of collecting data about what the police were doing, whether it was being successful. So he and his team tried to change that mentality. And, you know, something like that is really not easy to do, especially if you're working with, like I said, limited resources. But he did say that while the results weren't extraordinary, it was promising in terms of, you know, comparatively to what Giuliani had done in Mexico City. It seemed that there was more promise for this sort of what he called problem-oriented policing, where the police will go into communities and ask people what they perceive to be the biggest problems, how the police can help them, rather than having the police sort of impose their version of what public security would be.
So it was like a base hit instead of the flashy and brutal overpromise, basically.
Yeah, to an extent. You know, it was really much more community focused, much more focused on what everyday people thought they needed. And, you know, like I said, it's a really, really difficult thing to do. Takes a long time to change those ingrained practices, but he did indicate that his experiment showed some success.
Take us to Brazil for a moment.
Yeah. So Brazil is an interesting case because the sort of cleaning up the city aspect that we talked about earlier comes into play with the Olympics and the Olympics scheduled for 2016,
right,
and the World Cup that just happened last year. So Giuliani was contracted by Rio de Janeiro government officials to provide recommendations for how to help the city prepare for the games in terms of security. And it's hard to determine how much of an influence he really had. A lot of the information about what he's been doing in terms of his consulting on this issue is sort of hard to obtain. And I was able to speak with the CEO of Giuliani Security and Safety, who was not exactly forthcoming about what they were doing.
Really? Even for a Jacobin piece? I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just
kidding. Surprisingly enough,
yeah,
right?
Shocking. Right. Yeah.
So I did try to get a handle on that.
Well, that's interesting. Well, that's interesting because that sort of raises, I mean, there's several tracks to this conversation, and I want to get to the larger level corruption and in Latin America. But I think, you know, one of the things that's great about your piece is it's very important for understanding the context of what created gentrification in New York City. It almost was like kind of like when Marx talked about what he called primitive accumulation, with that sort of like first stage when you enclose a commons. It's not a direct analogy, but it went and got broadened to such a point with zero tolerance that, as you basically said, I mean, through harassment, that really did at a certain point just start to correlate with you not having a certain income, right? Which is maybe why, again, you're on your stoop or you're a street vendor or something like that. That set the stage for gentrification. That set the stage for sort of, you know, reading cleansing. I mean, that's not an overly brutal word to use. I mean, really overturning neighborhoods and setting the stage for gentrification. The other track, and it's very reflective when you talk about the Brazil example and kind of being like, what is it that Giuliani is doing? I mean, there's a lot of former leaders, Tony Blair. His post-prime ministerial leadership has been incredibly controversial, and he's jetting around the world and working in Colombia and working in the Emirates and working in Mongolia on energy and mining contracts. And on one hand, there's this sort of sense of, you know, this is really questionable double dealing and business using his contacts as prime minister and as a peace envoy in the Middle East. And then there's a whole other aspect of it, of like, you know, Kuwaiti civil society activists saying, like, you know, the government paid him some astronomical amount of money for, you know, some dull white paper that a graduate student can produce. And, you know, like that whole other sort of aspect of this. But I want to get to the piece about, you said, missing the link with larger kind of higher level corruption, with organized crime moving back into Mexico City. And really the sort of, those are the larger patterns that fuel the type of violence you're talking about in Latin America. One example I just raised briefly, and maybe you're familiar with it, but in the 1990s, and I'm not obviously not drawing a direct connection here, but it is a bizarre and disturbing parallel. The Cali cartel in Colombia, which was actually more powerful than the Medellin, the Pablo Escobar's cartel, and was sort of the upper class cartel. According to Manuel Castells, they practiced social cleansing. So what they would do is they would organize teams of gunmen in the Cali region, and they would kill what they called, what we in English, discardables. So they would kill gay people, prostitutes, leave their bodies on the street, and apparently hang signs, according to Castells, who's a respected academic, hang signs in Spanish that translated as clean Cali, beautiful Cali. And that was the sort of the their own version of cleansing the city. And when you think about the sort of unbelievable violence that's connected with cartels now in Mexico, with gangs affiliated with cartels in Central America, how does this, you know, this Julia, and how much that money is linked to governments across the region. And then Giuliani comes in, and it almost seems like, as you said in your article, just another version of perpetuating the traditional racial, economic, and ethnic divisions that have fueled these systems in Latin America to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, in the case of Brazil, and I think also probably Mexico City, there's probably less of the aspect of the corruption and the organized crime connection. I think mm-hmm. to a larger extent, it's more about the business investment. You know, you need mm-hmm. to, in the eyes of the business community and the elites, you need to sort of remove these undesirables in order to bring in investment. And I don't think that necessarily their intentions are entirely nefarious.
Sure.
You know, from speaking with Mr. Huvane at GSS, mm-hmm. he was saying that, you know, well, the idea here is that we make a place safer, and that brings an investment, and then people will get jobs, and we can pay for education, and then every, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats.
Right.
So I think that is sort of, they don't necessarily have those nefarious intentions, and I'm not sure how much the corruption angle plays into it. But when you're talking about organized crime, I think that's an important topic to discuss, especially when you're dealing with issues of policing.
Right.
You know, the other country that I mentioned in the piece was El Salvador, and they currently have a major problem with gang violence there. And so, you know, a major business group there known as ANEP, they brought in Giuliani and had him do another report where he had recommendations for the country. And he went down there to present the report. And during the presentation, he said that the country should aim to annihilate the gangs, which, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. that sounds great. I mean, no one likes the gangs. I don't know about no one, but, you know, most people think they're pretty bad and they do some horrible things. And so when he says annihilate them, I think a lot of people were on board with that. But, you know, the reality is a lot more complicated. These gangs are embedded in the social structure there. And so annihilating these gangs would involve annihilating an important, albeit maybe not so pleasant, part of the social fabric. So I think that, you know, again, it's sort of a simplistic way of looking at security when you say, like, we're just going to have zero tolerance for crime. That sounds really great, but when you try to put it into practice, I think it's a lot more complicated.
So as a final question before we wrap up, I mean, is the example that you pulled from the academic work in Trinidad, which, as you said, was very difficult to implement, it yielded modest returns, but it was something. Is that sort of low level, less grandiosity, and looking at the bigger picture, is that the path forward as an alternative to the sort of Giulianization of Latin America?
Well, I think it's definitely promising, more promising than the zero tolerance policies. And I think that humility is an important aspect here. You know, we don't necessarily know what works in terms of public security. I mean, there are lots of experiments and ideas out there, but I think, you know, it is important to be humble about what we know and what we don't know, and to sort of look at the evidence and try to base our policies off of the evidence that we can gather and what's available. And so that's, you know, another thing that, that the zero tolerance policy kind of ignores is the evidence collection aspect. You know, it just sort of assumes tautologically that zero tolerance towards crime will work, and so therefore you need to do that. But the evidence isn't there, so I think, you know, we need to look for what does work.
Well, Mike LaRusso, it's a great piece. We have it linked to on our website. It's Giuliani in Rio at the Jacobin magazine. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Have a good one.
You too. All right, everybody. We're going to get right to the fun half in just a moment. New Matt is looking really furious throughout that whole interview. I'm guessing that Giuliani was, fan.
No, I was just concentrating very hard.
Wow. Okay. That's awesome. We definitely, we nail it on eccentricity with this show. This is a really eccentric group of people. Starting at the top, obviously. Okay. So we're going to go to the fun half where I will take your calls at 246-257-3920, 246-257-3920. The IMs are open. Become a member of the Majority Report today. That's how this all happens. You are our bosses, many of you. You can do that very easily. Go on our website at majority.fm/member. It's less than a cup of coffee a day. It keeps us independent. It allows us to do the in-depth conversations on gentrification, crime, race, class, Latin America. Gets you Digby on for 50 minutes to give you not just like a rundown of the Democratic Forum on Friday, but like a history and a sociology. I mean, she's brilliant. It's and then sophomoric Ben Carson impressions. So we're really able to hit you from every angle. You can also support this show by going to justcoffee.coop, fair trade, tea, coffee, and chocolate. Obviously get the Majority Report blend. We drink it every day in this office. It's what fuels this program, and it's a win-win-win for everybody. It's a win for us. It's a win for the workers. It's a win for the environment, and it's a win for supporting the co-op economy. Give us a review on iTunes. You throw us 5 stars. You write a couple of sentences. It helps expose more people to the show. It makes a really big difference, and if you're going to use Amazon, use it through our link and shave a couple of pennies off of the evil Amazon empire. See you in the fun half. Kelly loves Amazon. She just rolled her eyes at me.